This podcast is brought to you by my own emotional workouts for your well-being training program. If you have no idea what that is, no worries. It's basically like a personalized workout program. But instead of doing 100 squats, you're working out your mind, your well-being, and your emotions. Think workouts, but for your well-being, backed by thousands of years worth of philosophy. When I was starting out in life, I would have benefited so much by having someone like Rumi or Plato or Aristotle to just be there by my side and coach me so I could design a life that was meant for me. Unfortunately, that's not available. Emotional workouts are the closest thing to just that. As you navigate through your life, emotional workouts remove all that stuff that gets in the way when you're trying to make those tough life choices. You can check it out at emotionalworkouts.com. Again, it's emotionalworkouts.com. Okay, on to the show. Welcome to this week's episode with Angelique Power. Angelique is the program director for the Joyce Foundation's Culture Program, which distributes $2 million annually. She focuses on strengthening and diversifying arts organizations, building capacity within the arts sector, and investing in creative capital of the artists themselves of color through the Joyce Awards. Angelique came to the Joyce Foundation with more than 15 years of experience in her work at the Museum of Contemporary Art. In today's episode, I feel like you're really going to get a firsthand look at somebody who's deeply in this world. She talks about growing up on the south side of Chicago as a Jewish African-American woman and her experiences with race starting in the 70s in Chicago to what she's experiencing to now. She shares her perspective of the complicated world of race as someone who's lived it and now dedicates her life to helping move the conversation forward in the arts community. I know you're going to find this episode really interesting and filled with an insight that most of us don't get access to. Hope you enjoy the show. As always, hop over to iTunes, subscribe, write a review. Every little bit counts. Thanks for listening. Today we have on the show Angelique Power. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Laura. I'm good. How are you?
Welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks.
So I'm very excited because Angelique and I go way back, actually to kindergarten. Mm-hmm. We've been friends. We grew up in the south side of Chicago. We went to the University of Chicago laboratory schools from kindergarten all the way through high school. And I'm very excited about our conversation today and getting into what it was like growing up, hearing all about Angelique's experience at the Joyce Foundation, the MCA. She's got so much great information to share. So thank you so much for coming on.
I'm excited to talk. You know, because we've known each other for so long, we tend to have these lunches and coffees where we kind of hit these different topics anyway about our lives because we knew each other throughout high school, then we went our separate ways and have had these different careers. So I'm just excited to have like a friend's conversation.
I am too. This is I've been looking forward to. So talk to me a little bit about, we often are over a coffee chatting about our life experience. And one of the things that comes up over and over is the sort of unique experience we had growing up in this neighborhood in the 70s. Maybe you could share a little bit about your perspective, your story of how you saw that time.
Well, I think it's an interesting time in the world right now. For context, we are talking to each other in Chicago. We have the issues of Laquan McDonald's shooting. That's just the video that's been released. We have protests that are happening in the streets, calls for the mayor to resign. And there's a lot of tension around race right now. And so our upbringing is actually pretty unique. You know, it was very unique in the 70s. It's unique today still in that we grew up, you were in South Shore for the beginning of our friendship, and then you moved to Hyde Park. I grew up in Bronzeville and then moved to Hyde Park. And so we were housed, living, our home was on in the historically black south side of Chicago. And our friendship began at the lab school, which today is an incredibly well-respected nationally, expensive private school in Chicago. And at that time, you know, my parents were very working class. My mother was a Chicago public school teacher. My father was a Chicago police officer. He worked three jobs. She worked two. And they could afford to send us to lab school without a scholarship. I still remember the cost was $7,500 a year, which at that time was like, you know, a lot of money. It's now like, I think, $28,000 a year, which is not comparable in terms of inflation. So I think it's actually gotten more expensive.
Excessively more expensive. Like all schools across the country, it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. But at that time, there was an emphasis put on not just having sort of helicoptered in a school on the south side of Chicago, but actually creating room for Southsiders and people of different races and means to commune together and compete with each other and skip school if that's what some kids decided to do together. So I think that we had a really unique upbringing where we have friends who were Chinese American, who were African American. There's me from a mixed family where my father, both my parents had passed, but my father was African American. My mother was white Jewish. The South Side, and especially Hyde Park, where we were raised, is predominantly Black and Jewish at the same time. So it's a really progressive, intellect was highly valued, and it was the 70s. So people were sort of kicking the tires of government and ideas. Civil rights was in full motion. And then we were just there, kids growing up together, you know, figuring out the world together. It was a special time.
And when I look at our class photos, the mix of children from different backgrounds was not something you typically see in a private school.
No. And I think what's really interesting is, to my mind, like the kids that were really cool one year from year to year, it wasn't because of their race or their economic background.
Yeah.
In fact, some of the city's wealthiest, most affluent families, they sent their kids to lab, and their kids were, you know, outcasts, but like, you know, some of them were kind of on the fringes. And some of the kids that were from, you know, further south than Hyde Park were some of the most popular kids that everybody wanted to be like. So I always said it had to do with your sense of authenticity and the competitiveness of lab. Like, nobody wanted to be perceived as dumb. That was like the burn,
right?
You know,
right. It was less. I actually remember calling you when my son started at lab, and people were concerned about the diversity there. And I was asking you about your experience, and I was like, did I miss something? And you said, you know, the biggest problem I faced at lab actually was whether or not I was smart enough to be there.
Right, right. Like, that was the big thing. Like, there were kids that were having days named after them, you know.
So how did that experience, I mean, I know how it shaped my experience, being, I'm Jewish, but I'm a white woman. So growing up in a predominantly African-American neighborhood and having friends that were Asian and African-American, every single type of background was a very unique experience. And I naively felt that that was how the world really was.
Right.
And I found that I didn't pick my friends based on race. I picked my friends based on how much I liked them.
Yeah.
It wasn't really anything I ever factored in. And I never saw what you see everywhere else in the world where people break out based on their racial category. People at lab didn't do that. And when I went to college, for me, it was very jarring, right? I was very confused by how everything was set up. How did that mold your, you know, early years as somebody from a mixed biracial family?
Well, I do think that every child of Hyde Park, when they go to college, they have an eye-opening experience, and they sort of realize the specialness of how we grew up and where we grew up. For me, the segregation in college was really surprising.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a free spirit in high school, and I was, you know, an urban kid. I grew up, I wasn't sheltered, shall we say. Like, it's not that I had never experimented with things. And when I got to college, I found that there were a lot, I went to University of Michigan, and I found that a lot of the kids were from rural areas in Michigan. I had people say to me they'd never met a Jewish person before. I had a Jewish person say to me, prove that you're Jewish.
Nice.
Which, yeah. You know, at that time I was like so thrown off and insecure in some ways. I did. I was like, you know, and then I immediately regretted having to prove myself.
Yeah.
You know, I should have just walked away and been like, proves whatever you are, you know.
But when it's sort of rampant throughout the, you know, and not that everybody was like this, but so much of culture outside of our bubble in Hyde Park is organized that way. I found myself doing the same thing all the time too, trying to figure out where I fit in, justifying, rationalizing. I may have told you the story, but I, you know, was in the college cafeteria and I got my food and I was a freshman and, you know, you don't know anybody and you're looking for tables. And I knew a couple kids from my dorm. Anyways, I walked up to a table of African-American kids. They seemed like they looked like nice people. And yeah. I kind of, you know, naively smiled and tried to make a spot for myself because I had met one of them in a class. I have never been more uncomfortable in my entire life. They looked at me like I was literally insane.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I didn't understand for quite a while what the problem was.
Right.
It took me a while to actually get what I had done wrong, right?
Well, not wrong, but you know, you surprised them.
Yeah. Yeah. What I had done that was fair, not wrong, but went against their experience of the world.
Right. They probably looked at you like, what do you want?
Yes.
Because when their past is when a white person approached them, especially in mass, it was because they wanted something or needed something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for me, it's like Judaism was something that that was clearly identified in your features or culturally. I met so many Jews who, and I still, you know, one of my best friends is one of these, quote unquote, like culturally Jewish people that have said, you know, I've never gone to temple, but I just grew up not eating shrimp or pork and I identify as Jewish. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But for me, my experience was very different. Like, I don't look Jewish. People don't assume I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
I went to Hebrew school twice a week. I was bat mitzvah, you know?
Yeah.
Ani medaberet Ivrit, which means like I speak Hebrew, you know?
I can attest because I saw your photo for my nephew's bar mitzvah on the wall at the temple.
And yet I still have questions about, you know, what it means. And, you know, like we all do sitting in a temple, we all have different ideas. We're all there for different reasons. So, but yeah, so to your original question, I think children of Hyde Park, when they leave, they realize that the world segments themselves into easily identifiable boxes and that you are expected to do so. And if you don't, then you are looked at with askance and curiosity and some skepticism.
And I think, you know, this podcast is obviously about authenticity and the art of authenticity. And I think this is such a great example because here we are growing up and what is authenticity, but really this ability to be the self that you want to be without values outside of you or other people's messages or, you know, all sorts of reasons that you are unable to stay in that authentic space. And to grow up in an environment where at least a lot of the race discussion could come off the table and you could really step forward from different backgrounds and make friends with different people. And that wasn't the thing that was defining you, I would assume made a big impact on your early years.
Well, I would say that it never really went off the table. Like when you're a person of color, you're always aware, like you do a quick count. You're like, how many people of color in this room right now, you know?
Yeah.
I do it all the time. I'm constantly like saying to my husband and my husband, now he's in on it, you know, we're like, okay, well, you know,
yeah.
It's just, you're constantly aware, but you're also, the way that I talk about growing up, especially being Black and Jewish, is that I grew up and became comfortable being a part of and apart from communities. And what I mean by that is being the brown girls, my sister and I, in a temple. So we were Jewish and we were there all the time and we were studying and having our thoughts and questions, but we were always the brown children in a predominantly white space. And then going to hang out with, you know, my father's side of the family and being in, you know, backyard barbecues and hanging with family over holidays. And we were the lighter skinned kids that talked white. And so it was always something that we were aware of. But so I think that's a good point, because I don't believe in race neutral or race agnostic, because it is there. But I do think that growing comfortable with, like I said, being a part of a community and being apart from it at the same time, because you are an individual, I think that balance and that friction is helpful.
And did you find it, and I think that's a very fair point, off the table is probably a strong comment, but
yeah,
less than what you might experience in a lot of other areas in the world where
it's
the defining feature.
Right. Like you're right. I mean, because while it's still there, it isn't the defining feature. You know, you and I were like spraying sun in our hair in that little red room, you know, that red closet room that you had, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And like blowing it dry, and, you know, our hair textures are different, and we weren't focused on that. We were like focused on how orange we could make our hair.
Right. It was something I, of course, was aware of. I wasn't blind to the fact that my friends have these different ethnic backgrounds. And quite frankly, it was part of the conversation. A friend of ours was Chinese and owned a restaurant, and we weren't, you know, pretending that wasn't happening for some weird PC reason. We just didn't go further with what that means about her, right? She was able to be herself and be Asian and own this restaurant. There wasn't all these sort of stereotypes that follow it such a huge clip, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some, but it's a reasonable amount that you don't feel stifled by them to the point that, you know, you feel defined or boxed in. Yeah. So, I mean, I left Hyde Park being on the phone with you and many other friends trying to figure out, okay, what's going on in the real world that we've missed out on and how do we catch up? You know, I continued through college, went on to run a business, and you've navigated a very different path, and you've landed in a space that I think with everything going on, like you said, in Chicago and being in your particular job with the arts and diversity, I'd love to hear your perspective of what is going on right now, how you define it, what the experience has been for you. Could you talk a little bit to that?
Sure. Well, so what I do now is I work at a foundation. I work with the Joyce Foundation. It's a private foundation. We give $40 million away annually. We focus on quote unquote quality of life in the Great Lakes region. And what that means is we break it down into these areas like education, environment, democracy, employment opportunities, and my area, gun violence prevention, which in Chicago and nationally is clearly a huge concern. And then I manage the culture program, which focuses on arts and culture. And the other areas focus on policy. Culture is different. We don't focus on cultural policy, but we're similar in that we have this laser focus on where we see an opportunity to level the playing field. And for us, that's diversity, equity, inclusion in the arts. And so, like an example, when you think about some of the largest arts organizations in Chicago, what do you think of?
What do I think of? The largest arts, I think of museums and...
Yeah, like the Art Institute.
Yeah, yeah, I think
the Lyric Opera.
Right, the big, huge...
The biggies.
Yeah, I mean, the MCA, the Art Institute, the Field Museum, right? I think of, you know... All I think of areas maybe too, where there's a pocket of a bunch of art studios, right? For in Chicago, we have River West, but yeah, I think of it in sort of these big ticket items.
Yeah. And in those places that we've named, they are in areas downtown primarily, or predominantly white neighborhoods.
Yep.
They have predominantly white staff members. They show predominantly white Eurocentric work, and they receive more money than the majority of other arts organizations. And let's just take Chicago. So there was a study that came out recently that found that 55% of the funds, 55%, go to 2% of the arts organizations.
Wow. 55% go to 2%
of the arts organizations.
Wow.
And they are the ones that I've named.
Wow.
So if the majority of funding is going to big Eurocentric white arts organizations, then we are underfunding, emaciating, and overvaluing. We're underfunding and emaciating some of our organizations, and we're overfunding and prioritizing others. Mm-hmm. So when you look at it just on the surface, you think, well, that doesn't make any kind of sense. But then when you actually take a racial equity lens to it and you say, we've created an oeuvre, a canon that is really not reflective of the country, of the city, of the world we live in.
And so what are some of the things you do to level the playing field?
So at Joyce, some of the things that we do is we fund some of these organizations that I've mentioned who are interested in systemic interventions, not like, hey, we have a Latino artist coming and we'd like a Latino audience and, you know, you guys like brown people, you should fund us, you know, which I'm joking, but that happens a lot. You know, we are not interested in that. That's episodic at best. We're interested in systemic interventions, organizations that are really saying to themselves, hey, we're not going to survive. If we don't actually become more endemically diverse, and we're not going to be relevant because arts that only speak to one culture are not relevant. And, you know, we can do better. And so we help those arts organizations that are looking at systemic interventions that are trying to figure out, they're trying to map their policies and processes and figure out where are they making decisions that would prioritize one race or one socioeconomic class over the other. So for example, if you are only hiring a curator that has come from a certain school or certain schools that are predominantly white schools that you have to pay a lot of money to be in, well, then you are making decisions that are deciding that are going to keep you exactly as you are, because those curators are going to find certain artists and always put them on the walls, which is going to attract a certain audience. And there you go. You know,
so in that example, like, I get it, but what would be the sort of systemic intervention that you would think
about? So here's a great example. And Steppenwolf, I'm going to give you a huge shout out right now because they are like the blue chip preeminent theater, right? They win Tonys constantly for their work. So what they're thinking about doing now, and they're raised money for it, is to actually turn a part of their organization into a recruitment firm for ALANA, which stands for African, Latino, Asian, Arab, Native American theater professionals across the nation. So Steppenwolf is a theater, but it's also a recruitment firm where they're traveling, they're meeting with people, they're finding the next theater professionals, ALANA theater professionals, and they're recruiting them for the entire theater industry.
So not just for Steppenwolf, for...
No. Nope.
Interesting.
So they're not looking at like, well, what do I need to do? Maybe I should have a multicultural fellow, you know, and then bring that poor person of color into a predominantly white space and then wonder why they aren't succeeding.
Yeah.
They're thinking, how do we actually rethink everything about our system and how we operate? Why does a theater have to just put something on a stage and have people in an audience?
Interesting. So the recruiting... and finding these people and bringing them to arts programs in Chicago?
Well, right now they're recruiting them to potentially bring them to theater companies nationally because they work nationally. They don't just work inside of themselves. But they do have cultivation programs inside, apprentice programs. The Goodman is another great example. You know, when we were growing up, the Goodman was like in the basement of the Art Institute. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That's and right. Now it's like moved over. It's like one, they call themselves a large community-based arts organization, which is so cool. And what they are interested in doing, they've created an apprenticeship program where they are recruiting from like veterans organizations and vocational like colleges and technical colleges to bring people in to work behind the scenes at theater. And they're paying them great, great dollars. And they're working with them as apprentices to train them while they're being paid well, so that then they can either stay at the Goodman or move on to other theaters. Because if you have Steppenwolf, the Goodman on your resume, you're moving on to another theater.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that's some of the work we do. A big part of our portfolio is actually funding arts organizations that are set in communities of color, that have arts administrators of color in the lead position. That's the bulk of what we do. Really unsexy funding. We pay salaries. We upgrade databases.
But it's, you know, I think systemic solutions are the key. I think so much time and energy has been spent to these one-offs, like you say. And so you were at the MCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art here in Chicago, Director of Communications for years. Now you've been at the Joyce Foundation. What have you seen change over the last 15 years, for better or for worse? What direction do you think things are headed?
Well, I think that my thinking has done a 180 since I was at the MCA. I was really working a lot on diversity issues, quote unquote. And I really thought that, like, helping a mainstream, predominantly white arts organization become more diverse, and you and I have talked about this. We've talked about the conversation of, like, you know, boards that are predominantly white. Why can't we find people of color, like, that meet our requirements? So all the ones that we have on our list are taken.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't like that. That is like a symptom of the systemic issue.
Yeah.
And when I was at the MCA, I was like, yeah, let's just, you know, let's recruit board members. It's like, if we can diversify our board, diversify our senior staff, diversify the pipeline, and then we'll diversify the artists, and then we'll diversify the audience. And the problem with that, and I always describe it like a restaurant, because diversity, inclusion, and equity, it's, those terms are used a lot interchangeably, and they're not interchangeable. I always say diversity is like you keep your restaurant the same and you invite a quote unquote like diverse group of people to come inside of your restaurant. Mm. That's what a diversity effort is. Like my restaurant's the same, the food's the same, but like I want a few people that are different, usually people of color, to come into my restaurant. Inclusion is also keeping your restaurant the same, but attempting to make sure that the diverse people that are inside your restaurant feel comfortable while they're eating there. Right?
So generous of them.
It's like, so checking in, like, is your food okay? You know? Yeah.
We'll be nice to you, including...
We'll be nice to you. Thank you so much for coming to our restaurant. And equity is about redefining the entire dining experience. So rethinking the doors, rethinking the walls, the system changes, the resources change, the power to invite someone in changes.
Yeah. Yeah, so that the experience doesn't need to have the effort of inclusion because it's already inclusive.
Right. Like these efforts, the issue is that they look at people of color, like, how do we get them into our system? Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I'm going to be very frank, and if we have to edit this out, then we have to edit this out. But but diversity, quote unquote, diversity issues are not about people of color. They are about white people. They are about white privilege that's baked into systems. They are about systems that unfairly privilege whiteness, that think whiteness is the canon and the norm and the standard bearer. And why can't people of color just come in and be just like that? Well, that's never going to work. Never going to work.
Right, right. It's like we comment on it that there's rainbow flags in restaurants to say that they're open to gay people coming in. And it's like, it's offensive that that's there. Like it's saying that we're one of few restaurants that we are friendly, right? Like that's
right.
The whole idea is ridiculous, right?
And yeah.
The problem isn't in trying to make a space that feels friendly for people who are not in the majority. It's about trying to change the mindset of the majority so that we don't need these things.
Exactly.
If I hear you correctly. That's
right.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I think it's spot on. I think it's a longer game. It sounds like you're invested for a longer haul than the sort of maybe quicker fixes, right? Where you feel good for a little bit, but it doesn't have the staying power.
Yeah, the quicker fixes haven't worked. They're really a lot of work.
Yeah.
And they're not long lasting. They're not sticky. They don't stay.
By the way, I'm not editing out your comment. I think it's awesome.
Okay. All right.
We have to have a little bit of our real coffee conversation show.
Okay.
Look, I agree completely with you. And I think it's such an incredibly powerful statement that alternative care, not to be crass. Of course, people are not the same as care systems. So I just want to say that so nobody sends me hate mail. But if you think
they're already going to send it to you if you're keeping this in, then.
But if you think about alternative care, right, it's already assuming that the care system that's in place is the care system, and anything outside of it is just like adjunct, alternative, secondary,
right.
Not as good. And that's just strange in of itself, right? I mean, those systems are actually powerful and amazing. I found a huge cure for something within myself by going in the quote unquote alternative care system. It's not alternative. It was incredible. Actually the mainstay system failed me, and this fixed my health issue. So it's, you know, it's funny how we label things. Or organic food is now organic, but in fact, the foods that's not organic, they're not really food, actually. If you, you know,
that's a great point.
It drives me crazy. I'm like, I say to my mother, who's like on the fence about organic food, it's the food you grew up with. And when you were a kid in the 40s and 50s, that was just called food. We moved away from it, and now we have all these chemicals in it. And now we're coming back to real food, and we put a label on it, right? Which is the strangest thing in the world to me. And people wonder if why I need the quote unquote organic. And I agree with them. It should be called food. And then the other side is just processed, right?
You know, it's exactly right. And actually, language is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And it's intentional, because it designs in this difference. And then you think that one thing is conventional, quote unquote, normal,
that's right.
Traditional.
That's right.
And the other is not. And so, like, even terms in the arts, like ethnic arts or culturally specific arts organizations, are misnomers, because the Art Institute is a culturally specific arts organization. It's white Eurocentric culture.
Yep. Yeah.
So if we label things as normal and other things as other, we are doing it a disservice.
That's right. And I think that's the main message that I hear you making. And I think it's an incredibly powerful one. I love it. Well, so on all of this incredibly valuable, interesting insight into the world you're in. You've had this incredible career. You started at Target, moved on to the MCA. You're at the Joyce Foundation doing this great work. And I know you're married. You have a beautiful little daughter. From the outside looking in, everybody would say, you know, this is a successful life. But the podcast, the real point is, you know, to talk about how success without a sense of authenticity, you know, isn't really a life that feels fulfilling.
Yeah.
And I know you personally, and I know one thing about you is you're an extraordinarily authentic person. Could you take a couple minutes and talk to me about what an authentic life really means for you?
Yeah. I mean, I wish there was like a different word besides authentic, you know, like I wish we could make up a word.
Well, and that's why I want to talk about it, because I think it's this buzzword that's thrown around, and I think it's complicated.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I would say about it is, like, as I've gotten older, I've placed a different value on feeling centered, you know, mm-hmm. like feeling like I'm being myself in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I know very well when I'm feeling off centered. And so I don't think that being authentic is always being centered, because I think that's impossible, you know?
Yes.
Like, I think that I have moments where I'm definitely in my groove and I feel great. And then I think, and it would be interesting to like figure out the percentage, but then I think, you know, other times I'm really not. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't think the authenticity is on the centered side. I think it's like, how do you handle the reality of that 40% or 50% of the time that you're off center?
Mm.
And do you doubt yourself? Do you like want to jump, you know, a helicopter out of your life?
Mm.
Do you trust that you're in a process and that it's going to go somewhere?
I love it. Yes. I mean, I think that's the key, right? Do you get off center and do something impulsive, jump ship, leave your wife, leave your family, to move to the other side of the country thinking that'll be the solution, and there you are, right?
Right. Like, I had a moment, I had shingles recently.
Oof.
Yeah. Right. And I totally, for the first few days, I kind of batted between thinking I was having a heart attack or a stroke, because it's like shooting feelings down my arm. Of course, I'm still like working. I might be having a heart attack, but I'm still going to do this conference call. So like batting between that and then going to the other side of like, there's nothing wrong. You know, you're letting this, whatever. So finally, you know, I go to the doctor and they say, oh, you have shingles. And that was probably after 2 days, which I think is, I've gotten better. from where I might have totally ignored it for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. It was also right after I saw a rash, which is the first sign of shingles. But when I was sitting after the doctor said it, I just started to cry. And he was like, it's okay. Like, it's treatable, you know? And, but the reason that I was crying is because I just wanted to wave the white flag of being a grown-up. Mm. You know, my parents have passed. You knew my parents. I like wanted my dad in his big old Lincoln Town Car to just come pick me up, you know, with my mom in the front seat, like probably smoking a cigarette, you know,
yeah,
and just like put me in the back seat and take me to their house. And like, I'm done. And yeah. I had that feeling and I let that feeling wash over me. And I'm not ashamed of having it. And I got past it. And then I went and got my damn prescription filled and went home and made, you know, my husband take care of me. So it's like, I think there are moments where you just feel those things and just to feel them, really feel them.
Because life is constantly moving. There's a quote from this poem from T.S. Eliot that I'm obsessed with, but, you know, that we're the still point in the turning world, right? And that I think of authenticity is that sort of still point in the turning world is kind of moving around. And it is moving, and it sometimes, like you said, it's shingles, it's a death in the family, but
it's doing like shitty in a meeting, you know, that yeah. you felt like you could do better. It could be something really small. You
Absolutely.
Know?
It's going out on the first date and it just went terribly, right? It's all of those things, but your reaction to it, whether you, and I love this point of yours that, you know, do you helicopter out? Do you doubt yourself? Do you stop trusting? Right. And I think that's where, in my words, right, the emotional weight starts to add in. And all of a sudden you start taking all sorts of inauthentic choices and making decisions from that space.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So did you always have this? I feel like you do. So I'm actually very curious about this. Did you always have this ability to weather the storm, recognize it was an emotional state and it is what it is and I'm going to create some space and move through it? Or did you have a turning point in your life where you learned to do this?
I think I learned to do it. Honestly, I don't think that and part of it, and I try to explain this, you know, when you have a child, you're often explaining things to them and yourself, but you're also telling them these big life lessons isn't necessarily like, don't touch the stove. It's that life is about trying, you know?
Yeah.
Life is the effort. And that's it. Like, it's the journey and you're not going to learn how to do it right away. So don't get frustrated. In fact, try to enjoy practicing. And so I think for me, you know, when I was younger, I used to write and I still do. I write in my journal. I write a lot. And I think being a third party observer in my life helps me a lot to sort of gain trust in myself as my own narrator. And that has been really helpful.
And when you say that, so a third party observer to sort of watch your own life, like you're reading a book, how do you, just, a lot of people write in journals and cry and scream and sob the whole time. How do you manage to write in the journal and then at the same time sort of become the observer? What's that practice look like for you?
Well, one of the things that I actually think it is about is letting yourself write for longer than a paragraph. Because I actually think it starts happening. You are the published writer, girl.
You know.
Of the two of us. So I think
you have about 100,000 more pages than me, though, since I've seen your journals.
Yes, but you have a bestseller, Emotional Obesity, available on Amazon.com, right? Which is fantastic. So, I think that a part of it is that, like, whenever you start, it's an entry ramp into yourself. And so it's normal to start and be like, God, I hate this mother. Yeah. Well, you know where I'm going. And to just start with a rant. And that's good. That's like a shaken up pop bottle exploding. But after a while, you get to a different place where you're sort of asking yourself, is this a pattern? Like, is this moment that I'm in? Like, what are the real implications of this? And those are the entries that are actually really enjoyable to go back on and read to see yourself get from one place to another. So I think dedicating time, and whether that's getting coaching from like an awesome person like you, because all of us need to check in externally, whether it's going to a therapist, whether it's writing in a journal, whether it's going for a run or doing yoga, or whether it's religion, all or a mixture of all of them. I love swimming. I feel like swimming is so spiritual. Mm-hmm. I think giving yourself space and taking yourself and your life seriously enough to reflect on it, I think that that helps a lot with that 50% off-centeredness. That's where the authenticity is hidden.
And I love this idea. I could not agree more. Authenticity isn't somewhere that you get to and stay there. It's like physical fitness. And that's why I use this metaphor, because I think it's perfect. You don't stay physically fit. It would be wonderful if I could hit the gym, get in the perfect shape and stay there, right? Like, the greatest thing of my life. Yeah. And it's the same thing with authenticity and feelings. It's like you can just push and push and push through these things. But if you don't stay with it and make a practice of it, it comes back to haunt you the next time, because life keeps happening, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's always another situation. And so when you're in a really stressful phase, I mean, you're facing something that causes fear, what do you do to stop making an inauthentic decision from that space?
I don't make a decision if I'm in that space. You know, like I call it being a half mile past healthy when I know that I'm too mad.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm just too mad. Like, someone cut me off, or, you know, I had a conversation with someone I love and I'm like pissed. And all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I left healthy. Like, you know, 10 minutes ago. So I'm a half mile past healthy. I'm not gonna be sending this email right now.
Yeah.
I'm not going to try to make a decision from this space. I'm not ready yet.
I love it. I love it. I can't tell you how many people I've interviewed have said, I just stop. Just, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's a really hard thing to learn to do. What do you do? Because, okay, so you're really, really pissed. Somebody at the office sent some email and it just rubbed you the wrong way. Your husband said something horrible and you were in traffic and you get cut off and you're just really, you're on the brink.
Yeah.
What do you do? So, like, I think a lot of people agree in concept, but what do you actually do to make sure nothing comes out of your mouth or an email doesn't just get slammed out and it's regrettable? Well,
in all fairness, I think my husband probably takes the brunt of me not pressing pause. I think he would say that's fair. So, you know, so in some cases I learned by just doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I sent the email. I said something I didn't mean, you know,
yeah.
And then I'm just like, I don't want to do that again. So, like, I will go into a different room at home and I will shut the door. I love the bathroom. I will shut the door and I will just turn on water and I will just sit down and I will just, like, give myself the time out, you know?
Yeah.
It helps me so much, which doesn't mean when I emerge, I'm like, here is wisdom and mana from heaven and I'm a different person. It just means I've calmed myself down enough to not act out in this space where I'm not feeling ready. So that's like a home thing. I think in other areas, what I try to do is just totally remove myself from that scenario. Like in the car, listen to music. I love,
yeah.
you know, jamming out. I think humor in other scenarios, like with work, there has not been one, I probably shouldn't even say this, but every place I've worked, I've imagined as like a television show. Like the MCA, we used to huddle in my office with my team and we would go through casting. Like, so-and-so, John Malkovich should play so-and-so. You know what I mean? We would just turn it into like a television show called Museum.
Yep.
And we would sort of, you know, we didn't even have to write the episodes because it would just be the meeting we just had, you know, but we would leave cracking up with perspective and we would just keep going. Like, nothing is as serious. And we would say this at the MCA, we worked across from Prentice Hospital and now Lurie Children's. There is a job where small people are, their lives are at stake, you know. An art museum is not one of those places.
Mm-hmm. And even though sometimes it feels like things that are not really primal fears that aren't, you know, you're really not at risk, it can feel that way. And getting perspective is so important. And I love the idea that you make the mistake in sending that email. God knows I've done it. And the pain point of going through that experience is so high that it actually teaches you, you know what, as angry as I am, and as pleasurable as it feels to send this email, the pain of having going through the process afterwards is so high. I just don't want to do this again. You kind of learn on this primal level to not do it.
What do you do?
I do something very similar. I I think I did all the things incorrectly too. I sent those emails. I yelled at somebody and, you know, you can't take it back, particularly in the work environment. It's just so toxic to lose it. So I have a couple trusted people where I can just have an unbridled, are you kidding me? I can't believe I can just let off some steam, but go for a walk if I really need it. I mean, for me, yoga is my reset button. I sort of think of yoga as, you know, when your computer, like nothing is working and you just have to reboot, like hold the button and just let it just die and start over. Yeah. For me, yoga feels like that. It's just like, okay, I'm really at the end. Nothing's working. None of my friends are making me feel better. Like I can't convince myself. I can't get out of it. So I'll go do a big yoga practice and some meditation. And that typically gets me in the right place again. And, you know, if that doesn't work, it's a sign that I'm working too much or I'm overwhelmed and I need some more personal space. So I will take some time to think about my life, what's gotten out of balance. Maybe it's time for a day off. Maybe it's time for, you know, a walk in the park without electronics for a few hours. Mm-hmm. But if none of those things are working, it's really me at that point. But I get out of the narrative that it's the other person or the situation.
Yes, that's good.
Well, Angelique, thank you so much for being on the show. You've shared incredible stories, information. I've learned a lot. And your story of, you know, how to navigate an authentic life is so appreciated. I appreciate you coming on today. It was a lot of fun.
Well, I love you, Laura. You're really fantastic. Thanks for doing what you're doing for everybody, myself included. And I love talking with you.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you very much. And we'll be in touch soon. Let's have that coffee.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.